It is customary that on the last lecture of the lecture season that the topic be devoted to Swami Vivekananda and his teachings. The first lecture of the season is devoted to Sri Krishna, and the last lecture of each season is devoted to Swamiji. Now, of Swamiji's lectures, there are so many outstanding things, so many specialities can be quoted, can be referred to. One lecture which is extremely significant and absorbing is the lecture called God in Everything. And that was delivered in London on the 27th of October, 1896. It is based on one of the Upanishads, the oldest, as commonly judged, the oldest of them. It was found in, this Upanishad is found in the Rig Veda, which is itself considered of great special antiquity. So one can suppose that that lecture had, you know, embodied something very fundamental that has lived, that has survived for all these thousands of years. Because the date of this Veda is not at all known with any real certainty, but it's thousands and thousands of years ago. And it is remarkable in that it is the shortest of the Upanishads, but it has, it, you could say it's an embodiment of the fundamental principles that all the Upanishads want to demonstrate. And even that is too long. You could make it even shorter. It has been condensed into four great sayings called Mahavakyas, the great sayings. The whole of Vedantic teachings can be condensed to that. And each one of them itself, each one of these four great sayings itself is the whole that is being referred to by all of those four sayings. So actually, the significance is there's only one. you can condense the basic teachings of Vedanta into just one saying. And then you can think, well, why should I even bother to be that explicit? I should be able to condense it into even less than that. And so it is, even, you can even go further than that and say, why should anything be said at all? Just simply being should give you the whole truth of everything. Because if it's not true in every moment of time, then you could say it's a derived truth or a derivative truth. It's something that is not the very core, the very essence. Actually, silence is all that is needed. And why is that? Why is it that we can condense this mass of teachings called the Vedas, which is a huge compendium by itself? Why is it that we can condense it to, say, several Upanishads and condense that to something still more pithy? And then finally four basic statements, and finally maybe only one, and finally nothing at all. What that implies, what that is trying to say is that nothing need be said at all. The truth, the reality, the essence, the substance of everything is immediately apparent to every one of us all the time. You don't have to say anything. If you're in a certain place, if you're in San Francisco and you see the Golden Gate Bridge, you don't have to explain that the Golden Gate Bridge is in San Francisco. These things are perfectly evident. All you need to do is to see the bridge, and that itself conveys all the information about it, the glory of it, and the importance of it, the strength of it. Everything is conveyed in one glance. And the basic statement of Vedanta really is that everything is conveyed by our own understanding, by our own deeper realization every moment. Every one of us is aware of the whole truth every moment. That is the statement that is made. And if we were not aware of that, then no matter how much glorious lecturing I can do from the platform or anybody can do, all the several hundred Upanishads, all the Bibles, and all the other sacred texts would only be trying to ascertain something that we should be able to immediately perceive. When you hear something that appeals to you, that makes sense, yes, that does seem like the truth, you say. So it is only then that anything has any meaning. Otherwise, we can write most flowery and beautiful compositions and they'll be just seem to be beside the point. There is something within each one of us that understands the ultimate reality, that understands the infinite and the eternal in its fullness. At this very moment, each one of us is fully cognizant of that reality. That is why, when it's put in scriptures, in the scriptures, when it is told to us by Swami Vivekananda, who gave this lecture in London in 27th October 1896, that's why it communicates to us. It tells us, yes, we respond to it. Yes, this is true. And without that, without our cooperation, all the saints and sages can talk from now until eternity, and nothing will make any difference. It's when this enters into our ears, that's why these scriptures are called Shruti. It's something that has to be heard. When we hear it, there is an instantaneous response that tells us, yes, this is true. This is so, this is real. But we quickly forget it, and so then we have to have it told to us again. And because it's impractical that, constantly we should have some servant around that constantly reads the scriptures to us. Of course, we can put it on a tape. Some people put it on a continuous tape, so it's constantly these mantras or whatever is constantly being repeated, and somehow slowly maybe an inner awakening takes place. Yes, I do know all of this. But without that inner awakening, that realization that, yes, this is true, that is absolutely essential. And without that, you could write from now till infinity and nothing significant would happen to us. So this lecture that Swami Vivekananda gave there in 1896 is based on the Ishavasya Upanishad, as I said, the oldest, one of the oldest of the Upanishads. And the key to it, the key to this Upanishad is in the first verse. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. Isha, by means of the Lord. That has to be defined, what we mean by Isha, what we mean by Lord. Isha Vasyam, it is to be that this idea of divinity, everything is to be invested, clothed. Vasya means to actually be clothed in. Everything is to be enveloped in this idea of divinity. That is the basic statement, that whatever is perceived has to be covered with that. Every perception, the truth in every perception is that divine, what we call the divine reality, the nature of which we have to discover as time passes and as we make our effort to understand. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam, all of this, Idam, this, Sarvam, all, has to be covered. Vasyam has to be covered, is to be covered with the Lord, with that supreme principle, whatever name you give it. When I say Lord, it may not mean anything to everybody, but the idea is that there's a divine principle, there's an all-pervading principle, an all-pervading reality. Everything has to be covered with that. Everything has to be seen as a manifestation of that. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam, everything has to be seen as being divine. Now that is a challenge, because when we examine things, we see them differently. When you really examine, you say everything has to be covered with the Lord. Every experience is an experience of God, but I don't feel that. I see physical things and I think of intellectual things. I don't see anything all-pervading, divine, or extraordinary about my perceptions. But that is what the statement said. One has to be able to see that. Now, how is it? How can we justify that? How can we try to understand that? That everything has to be covered by whatever it is that we call Lord. It is something without boundaries, eternal, infinite, some divine means undying, eternal principle is to be seen in everything. That is the basic instruction of religion. Really, everything else is secondary, superficial details. Some people say, okay, now you have to go to a certain place of worship and you have to bow down before a certain symbol, and the symbols vary, and then slowly, and then you have to repeat certain words, you have to do certain ceremonies, you have to observe this and observe that, all these things you have to do. But those are all secondary things. The first thing is to feel that there is a reality, that the essence of everything is not material. That is to say, it's not something that is coming to existence and will eventually disappear. The essence of everything has always been and always will be. Time itself arises in that, from that. It is not in time. Time itself arises from it. That is the statement that is made. So then if you say, well, okay, it's very difficult. All I know when I investigate whatever I see around me, I take it apart and I examine it in so many different ways. There's destructive testing. I completely tear it apart. I find out what it is. So I never see anything particularly universal in it. Eventually, I come down to atoms and molecules and maybe fields of forces, electromagnetic field of force. There's various nuclear forces. I get down to these things. But I keep on going. There's no end to it. The fundamental forces that I come to themselves break down to sub-fundamental forces. I mean, everything becomes, the closer I look at it, the more diffuse it gets, the more imprecise it becomes, the more questions are raised. The more questions I answer, the more questions are raised. But that's because I'm looking at it mechanically, analyzing it. Now, is there another way of looking at it? Another way is this that I have frequently mentioned before, but I mean, it's so difficult to really understand the significance of it, to go beyond the simple presentation of the idea. And yet it itself contains the hints that can get to the core of this reality. Because our basic question will always be, this thing seems solid, it doesn't seem to have anything divine about it. Divine means it's an infinite, unbounded, eternal essence. I don't see any of that in any of these things, nor in any of the things that I can think about. None of that seems to be apparent. But it is apparent. It is apparent, and it can be seen, it can be apprehended, it can be followed. And the example that is usually given is from the Chandogya Upanishad. Just as all things made out of a certain substance can be described, like all things made of gold, different names, different forms, different functions, but they're all made of gold. So all of these things that we perceive are in essence God, infinite, eternal, all-pervading, whatever name you want to give to it. But only on the surface, this is how they look. So when we say we don't believe, we cannot accept the idea that there is divinity at the heart of everything, that there is an infinite, eternal reality at the heart of everything. We cannot understand that, is because we are looking only at the surface of things. And when we examine anything, we're only examining the surface. We're only taking apart the appearance, what appears, what appears to the senses. But if we ask, really, what is all of this made of? Really, it is in my consciousness that all this appears. Everything that we point to as being in the external world, really speaking, is in my consciousness. Whatever we're looking at is in our, we're looking at it in our consciousness. Our senses, what we see, what we hear, what we touch, what we think, what we feel, all possibilities of human life are within us. It's within us that we see, that we experience all this. I don't have any real proof that there is anything else. And that is a pretty profound thought. And you say, well, that's not realistic. I can't carry on my life in that way. Now, that's true. You can't carry on your life in that way. But we're not talking about carrying on of life. What we're talking about is, what is the nature of everything? What is the essence of everything? And when you have to carry on your life, you're obviously talking about something on the surface. You have certain things to do. You have certain things to think about. And, you know, thinking, feeling, willing, doing, all these things are there. So then I am dealing only with the surface of things. But I'm never answering the question, what are they really? What are they? What are all these experiences of mine? Every experience is a perception of God. That is to say, a perception of the infinite, the eternal, the all-pervading, the essence of everything. That is the statement that is made. Well, that's ridiculous, you say. I have no indication of that. Be quiet, and then you will experience it. That is the statement that's made in the Bible. Be still and know that I am God. See, that is not from any of us. You can accuse our literature of being biased. Oh, you people only believe in the Upanishads. So, you know, well, other people have tried other things, and we can't necessarily accept everything you say. Okay, fine. The Bible also says, be still and know that I am God. Of course, it can be interpreted in other ways, but if you interpret it in this way, it is in that stillness that you know God. That is the whole point of meditation. The purpose of meditation is to quieten this, the vrittis, the waves, the waves in the mind, the perceptions, the memories, the experiences, the tendencies that appear in the mind. Chitta vritti nirodha, that is yoga, the quieting of those waves in the mind. And what is the result of that? When those waves are quietened, when the disturbances of this mental ocean are quietened, then what is at the heart of that ocean? What is at the basis of our perception? All our perceptions are in our mind. What is at the basis of those perceptions manifests itself. So when the vrittis are, the waves in the mind are quietened, it isn't that anything new is created. It's that our vision becomes clear and we're able to perceive and experience the very essence of our reality, of our personality, of our being, and the essence of everything. And what do we find that it is? Again, according to the sages who from very ancient times have done this, what is it that we experience? We experience an infinite, eternal, and unchanging ocean of reality, which is all existence, all consciousness, and all bliss. We don't know what bliss is either. Bliss is ananda. We call it ananda, but what is that? Is it something that, you know, a great joy when you go up and do something tremendous? That joy is there, but that's not what's really being referred to. Perceptions of that joy are there. But the very existence itself, without any of these superimpositions of our daily experience, that very existence itself is totally unalloyed bliss. That is the statement. We perceive a little bit of that every night when we go to sleep. if we get sound sleep, what is it that we experience there? You can't really say. There's no particular experience. You're not experiencing any particular thing. But every night you need that state. If you don't get it every night, you become very disturbed and emotionally disturbed and you feel, no, there's something missing, and you go to all sorts of chemicals to try to induce that state. We desperately need that. Oh, yes, we need it in order to rest. Yeah, the body rests during that time, the mind rests during that time, but in what do they rest? In that deep sleep, we get a little, it's still a state of ignorance. It's still not an experience, an unalloyed experience of that reality, but it's getting closer to it, and we feel the attraction of that, because that is our own nature. There are two powers, avarna and vikshepa, that are present in our minds. Avarna is the hiding of the reality, and vikshepa is the projection of another reality. So we don't perceive Brahman, or the infinite, the eternal self, that is the very essence of us. And something else, this universe, is projected instead. So at night, that projective power is gone. The veiling power is, the way it's analyzed, the veiling power is said to be still there. So we're not, you can't say you wake up a knower of Brahman, but because ignorance is still there, but it has been vastly reduced. And the disturbance, the distraction has been removed. So one feels much closer to that, and one gets a great deal of bliss out of that. And we demand that every night, yes, whatever is necessary to achieve a sound night's sleep, we have to have. And if for a long time we can't achieve it, then mentally we become very upset, very disturbed. Anyway, this all goes back to this Swamiji's presentation of this lecture, God and Everything, which is based on that Isha Upanishad. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kincha Jagatyam Jagat, whatever in this world, Jagatyam, whatever in this world, Jagat moves. In other words, whatever reality we perceive has to be covered with the Lord. That means it has to be seen in its essence as a divine reality, meaning it is eternal and it is totally satisfying. That is our essence. Within each one of us, in the heart of each one of us, in the mind of each one of us, that golden reality is glittering. That's what drives everything here. It's looking for that reality everywhere. We look for it everywhere, but instead of looking for it where it can more easily be found, we look at it in the most difficult places. So we go out. We feel it is necessary to go out and find it out there somewhere. Actually, it's in our own being, our own reality. If we can achieve that inner serenity, then slowly we begin to perceive that that's where it is, that's where the reality is. So this is the lecture, and some of the things in it we can talk about. And so I'll quote a little bit from Swami Vivekananda from that lecture, God and Everything. He says, the Vedanta does not in reality denounce the world. The ideal of renunciation nowhere attains such a height as in the teachings of the Vedanta. But at the same time, dry suicidal advice is not intended. It really means deification of the world, giving up the world as we think of it, as we know it, as it appears to us, and to know what it really is, deify it, it is God alone. That is the real message. That is the total message of Vedanta. Whatever, every perception, every thought, every action, everything totally is totally surrounded, interpenetrated, interfilled with an eternal divine reality, which is all bliss and all consciousness and all satisfaction. So where do we find God? The answer is, where do we not find God? There is not a particle of space, not the tiniest region of space, not the smallest section of time that is not filled with God, filled with divinity. That has to be understood. Now, not just intellectually understood, it has to be understood within the heart. Swami Vivekananda makes a certain point about the heart and the difference between the heart and the mind, which really means the heart and the head. The thing is, it's in the heart that all this is really understood. In the head, everything has to be analyzable, has to be determined, has to be broken down in terms of subjects and objects and causes and effects. All of that connection is there. And it is extremely important for us that we have that. That's how we manage in this world. We manage in this world by having a very precise analysis of the situation that we find ourselves in and trying to improve, trying to develop, trying to become established, trying to have a satisfactory, fulfilling existence. So the head, the mind, the mental aspect is extremely crucial. But if we neglect the heart, then we miss the inner content of it. The mind will give us, will improve our universe, our experience of the world, and will defend us, protect us from errors. But it is the heart that senses the ultimate reality. Development of the heart is what gives us the insight that slowly introduces us to the reality of God within our own being. So it is not only that things can be totally logical, but if you go far enough in logic, you find there's always a boundary beyond which you cannot go. Logic always has a limitation. It is the heart that goes beyond that limitation. When you come to the edge of the experience of things, that where the mind has taken you as far as it can and then left you still with a question, it is the heart that probes deeper and finds the question answered. The fact, the scriptures, not only of Vedanta, of all religions, say God is that entity which they call the Supreme. Every religion has given some idea about that. Even the Buddhists, who don't believe in a creator, preserver, helper, sustainer, God, they have saints and sages, they have the Buddha nature. Not only that, they take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. Those are the basic refuges that the Buddhists are required to subscribe to. even though the idea of God as such, as understood in perhaps Christianity and other religions, is not there. But what is there is something that is effective in doing what these things do for other people. There always has to be that, the heart has to be involved. You take refuge in something. When you're very young, you take refuge in your mother. It's not a logical thing. It's not something that you've decided, yes, I take refuge in my mother. The mother itself, that very impulse, the very being of the children consists in their having taken refuge in the mother. They have been born from the mother, but it's that relationship. It's not through the head, it's not through the mind, through the intellect, through the analysis that relationship occurs, that relationship is supported. It's supported by a deep feeling of relationship, of identity, of oneness. So that has to be developed within ourselves in order to be able to perceive, in order to be able to, you know, understand that basic principle, that the universe is totally filled with God, with infinity, with eternity. How do you see that? How do you imagine it? How do you grasp it? What do you do with it? You fill yourself with that idea. And that can only be done by an intuitional recognition of the truth of it. It's not going to be provable in terms of mathematical formulas or definite digital analysis of this and that. It's not going to be proved that way. It's going to start as an assumption. It's just like you cannot prove, you know, the feeling that you have for your mother. You cannot prove that. It's something that is within the being. It perceives the essence. It perceives a relationship that is the core of one's being, and that is the relationship with the mother. There is this relationship with God is even at the core of the core of that. Even that relationship takes place, you know, in a yet deeper region. So the thing is, we have to feel the reality of that. Otherwise, say meditation, you want to quieten the waves of the mind, okay? Chitta vritti nirodha, you try to quieten the waves of the mind, and to some extent you have a success. But what you finally perceive is beyond the mind. It's beyond calculation, beyond intellect. It's something that is perceived at a deeper level of our personality. If I try to, okay, I will believe in the truth of that divine principle, in the truth of God, when I can get some proof of it. You will never believe in the truth of God, because that entity is not available to that sort of investigation. It is available to the heart. It is available to the feeling of the truth of it, and you have to examine within yourself, do you feel the truth of it? Does that make sense? And you do it, you start off with a little bit of an acceptance, because we're never totally left without the experience, without a divine experience. Something happens in our life, something totally unexpected. And say some difficult situation has started, has entered into your life. And you say, okay, this will be a challenge. You say, okay, this is a very difficult situation that has come up, and how am I going to get out of it? Okay, these people all say if you pray to God, you will get results. But you don't basically believe in this sort of thing. Where is that God? Where is that? What is the proof of it? I would not do it because it doesn't seem to be reasonable. But you get to a certain state where a little more desperation enters, and you begin to feel, yeah, okay, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but for heaven's sakes, I am in a difficult situation. I am going to rely on this. I am going to call upon that reality, to see that that reality, that divine principle, is at the heart of everything. And I'm going to surrender to that. That is the heart of religion. Surrender is the heart of religion. What are you surrendering? You're surrendering the finite to acquire the infinite. That's not much of a surrender, but it looks like a surrender when you're looking at it from the outside. Who would not want to surrender the small for the large, which is what you're doing? So you're surrendering the finite for acquiring a relationship with the infinite. But let's say now you're in a difficult situation and you decide, okay, this will be my gamble. You know, I'm in such a situation. Everybody says that this is, you know, this, you know, there is a reality beyond that which is apparent. And so I'm going to surrender to that. I'm going to feel, yes, there is a reality beyond the apparent. So I fill myself with that reality and I say, all right, I surrender to this. Please help me. And it's a bet, you could say. If you're really there and if you help me, then I may consider, you know, applying to you further and, you know, worshiping you and doing all these little things that you ask people to do. I've hesitated to do that because I really don't believe you exist. But now I'm in a desperate situation, so I'm... Anyway, whatever the method is that you begin to feel the reality of that divine presence, whatever the method is, whatever the excuses, whatever the reason for it, whatever the procedure, you begin to do this. Okay. And you find it does work. Something has changed. That desperate situation you were facing has modified to some extent. Anyway, not that it has been necessarily solved, but something has happened to, you know, give an uplift of thought, an uplift of reaction. Maybe some little thing, and you say, well, okay, that's all right. I was probably an accident. I mean, it probably would have happened anyway. The fact that I actually felt the presence of it, that divine reality, and surrendered to that and filled myself with that and asked for some sort of resolution. That resolution came, but it could have been an accident. Anyway, something, in other words, some relationship with the infinite and the eternal has been established, a little tiny bit. And you say, well, okay, maybe it's not really an imagination. Maybe there is something here. There's a reality to what, you know, that the reality of everything, it does enter into the totality of things. But you're not fully convinced. Anyway, your mind has been that strong mental hold has been slightly shaken and the heart has begun to enter. Anyway, if that happens again, then you begin to feel, you know, there may be something to this. Maybe what the sages have been telling for thousands of years and inscribing in all of these scriptures, maybe there is something to it. Anyway, I'm not saying that You shouldn't understand this. I'm promising anything like this is going to work. It's something for you to try. But I know it does work for some people, and did work for some people that I know of. That somehow you have to get a contact with that eternal reality. God has to become a reality in one's life, has to become of some significance, as to be, so that you say, no, it is not simply an imagination of a few people. There is a reality there. There is something there. And you're willing to go on with it and increase your relationship with it. The point is that somehow, I mean, we're here, we're in a desperate situation. All of us are going to, one day, we're going to majestically walk off the plane of this world. That much is absolutely certain. You don't have to have any great teacher come to you and tell you that this is going to happen. Every one of us is expecting that one day we will majestically walk off the plane of this world. And then what? The thing is, again, we go to the sages. We don't really believe what they say, but, I mean, we go to them for guidance. Yes, yes, okay, you'll be born again. And then some other people dispute this. No, why should you be born again? Anyway, there are strong arguments to be made. I won't make those arguments now. But if you don't realize God now, you will be born again until you realize God. That is a statement that is made. So nobody tells you to rush or hurry into anything. Take your time. That's fine. These are the consequences. Everyone will move off. And then the question is, when you move off, is that moved off permanently or is that temporarily and you reappear? So, but the main point is that the statement that is made is, all religions will say something. They may not say that you will be born again, but there'll be an experience of some sort after death. Nobody simply says that this will be extinction. Although all that we have on this, from the outside, it looks like extinction, but the inside it is not. And even medically, it has been discovered by doctors who study this. The near-death experiences, there are strong arguments to be made that something else, something does occur afterwards. This is not the end of things. Anyway, the point is that God, that the conclusion that Swami Vivekananda points to in this lecture is this Isha Upanishad. Now, this Isha Upanishad has a number of very startling verses. So the first one I have quoted, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam, that everything should be covered with the Lord. Then it's a Tena Tyaktena Bhunjita, that means by means of that renunciation, in other words, you are actually renouncing the appearance of things by superimposing on every perception that this is really a perception of God. By renouncing the appearance of things, you accept the essence of things. That is a profound thought, that there are actually two ways of looking at any perception. One is how it appears on the surface, and the other one is what it is really like. And what it appears on the surface, people will obviously agree on, but what it is really like is where religion comes in and makes its statements. So you're renouncing the appearance for the essence, and that should be the rule of our life. That should be the essence by which we live, because it is the appearance of things that gives us all our trouble. It is the appearance of things that promises great joys, great rewards, and eventually we all die and that all disappears. So it's the appearance of things that causes all of our uncertainties, all of our sometimes very positive results, sometimes very negative results. But the Upanishad asks us to go beyond the appearance, go to the reality. That is what we're talking about. The appearance is, if we accept the reality of the appearance, we end up in a problem. That is a very basic statement that's very difficult to deny. So we should look for the essence of things. What is the essence? And the statement is made that the essence is a divine reality. That is what we have to discover. That is what we have to experience. So it is, the Upanishad further goes, kurvanneva karmani, jijivishe chatagam samaha. So doing work, like this, in this way, by renouncing the appearance and striving to attain the essence, you should expect, you should desire to live as long as possible. In this way, this is the way, then it goes on the last half of the verses, in this way, karma, that whatever you do in this life will not cling to you. Because our problem is that the negative effects of work, we don't mind the positive effects, but we're very much concerned with the negative effects. Neither the positive nor the negative of our actions will cling to us if we give up the appearance and struggle to find the essence of things. And the essence of things is God, the infinite, the eternal. That should be written in our minds in bold gold letters. Look beyond the appearance. Beyond the appearance of every perception is the infinite, is the divinity, is God. That is the message of religion. How you deal with that, attaining that essence, that each religion will have its own ways and they'll all disagree. But the fact that things are not what they appear, beyond the appearance there is an infinite sub-current or sub-reality underneath everything. That is the message. And each religion will tell you a different way of achieving that. But the idea is, there is such a thing, you go for that rather than for the appearance. That is the basic message. So, other verses there in this Upanishad, it moves, it does not move, it is far off, it is very near, it is inside all, it is outside all. He who sees all beings in that Atman, and who sees the Atman, the inner reality, the essence in all beings, he feels no hatred for anyone. Yastu sarvani bhutan, yatman yevanupasyati, who, this one who sees sarvani bhutani in all beings, who sees the Atman in all beings. Sarva bhuteshu chatmanam, he sees the Atman in all beings, and he sees all beings in the self, in the Atman. That is the ultimate that we're trying to reach, to see that, to go beyond the surface, go beyond the appearance and see and underneath all appearances an inner reality of truth. And that within all then to see that truth in all beings, to see all beings within that truth and that truth within all beings, in both respects. That is the aim, that is what we're trying to see. to see God in everything and to see everything in God. That all actions, all everything that is performed, everything that is all of our experiences are within an ocean, within a lake, within a surrounding, totally surrounded by God. Now then you say, well, what is God? What is that infinity? That is the thing that we have to struggle for, to perceive that. And the more we put the surface as secondary and concentrate on experiencing the inner reality, the essence of things, we will draw closer and closer to that understanding, to that experience. To see in all experiences the Atman, and to see the Atman in all experience, in all respects, to feel totally surrounded, totally interpenetrated with that reality, to feel the presence of that, feeling the presence of God. There was a Christian saint, Brother Lawrence. What he saw on a winter's day, he saw a tree, a bare tree, and somehow the idea that this tree would soon in the spring be covered with leaves and flowers and fruits, somehow that elevated his mind to that consciousness of seeing divinity as being responsible for all changes, for all actions, for all events, as being the moving force behind everything. And that it became such a permanent experience that he always felt that. Whatever he did, he felt that he was doing it for that divine reality, and that the divine reality was within him, giving him the ability to do all those things. These are the this verse here. Yasmin sarvani bhutan yat baiva bhut vijanataha. So for yasmin, in whom all beings have become that reality, tatrako moha kashoka ekattvam anupasyata, tatra there, ko what moha, quad moha is delusion, what delusion, kashoka what sorrow can there be for a person, ekattvam anupasyata, for a person experiencing this ekattvam, eka is one, ekattva the state of oneness, that divinity is present everywhere and everything is present within that divinity. This is something that we should feel, it is not something intellectually we will conceive. We should feel the reality of that. That's why when meditation is done, usually meditation is done in the heart, we deliberately place a sacred object, whatever divine reality we're aiming for, deliberately place that. Imagine that it is placed within our heart. And then concentrating on that, feeling oneness, feeling closeness, feeling the truth of that, all these things come through the heart. And how that is done, that's an excellent exercise that we have to practice. It may not come naturally, it may not come, suddenly one fine day this feeling comes, but slowly it should arise within all of us. If it is true that God is present within everything and everyone, there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't experience that and perceive it. And it's through the heart, through this feeling, through this process that we're able to approach that and achieve this tremendous realization, which is been the record of saints and sages who have gone this way. Thank you.